Well, it was the biggest collective art theft in history, the looting of hundreds of thousands of works of art and other precious objects by the Nazis during World War II. The art was removed, I suppose you could say, on an ideological basis, but that didn't mean its value didn't remain highly prized. Some was reportedly destined for an art gallery that Adolf Hitler wanted to build in his hometown of Linz in Austria. It was squirreled away, and after the fall of the Nazis, some of it was found hidden in a salt mine in Germany. In recent months, the spotlight has fallen on the incredible and sustained efforts by one family, that of the modern art dealer and collector Paul Rosenberg, a friend of both Picasso and Matisse, who fled Paris in 1939 when war was declared. Up to date, three generations of Rosenbergs have been involved in tracking his collection down and offer a real model for some others. Mark Mazurowski is an art search specialist who has served on the Presidential Advisory Commission on Holocaust Assets. He's also the co-founder and research director of the Holocaust Art Restitution Project, one of the groups working to track the paths of stolen items, and about whom there's been quite a bit of interesting writing lately in the New York Times. He joins me now from New York. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Hello, how are you?
Look, I think a lot of listeners, Mark, might think that this is an old story, but your writing alerts us to the fact that it's very much ongoing, isn't it?
It is. Well, I mean, theft has happened continuously through the ages, and it's not about to stop. But what makes this theft a little different is that it was performed in the framework of crime against humanity, and also it led to some unprecedented, let's say, international decisions regarding these types of crimes, because they can't be subject to limits, and therefore any theft that was committed during the commission of one of these major crimes against humanity can be prosecuted until the moon basically turns to cheese.
Yes.
I mean, I'm exaggerating, but unless someone's or groups of governments basically say, okay, enough is enough, this is going to continue.
Well, that's what I was getting at. I think myself, a lot of listeners would think, well, they've got most of that art back, haven't they? What's the story? You make the point that only about 5% of art has been restored, and the efforts to find it are still very alive.
Correct. Nobody really knows exactly the extent of the theft. Nobody has done an audit on an exhaustive scale in the 19 countries where these thefts have occurred. It depends what you count. Are you counting every fork, knife, and spoon? Are you counting every book? Because we're not just talking about paintings. We're talking about musical instruments. We're talking about rugs, tapestries. We're talking about accessories, netsukis, I mean, even primitive art. We're talking about all sorts of things. And as long as it was owned by a family or by an individual and an entity and it was illegally removed, it is part of that theft.
Tell us about Paul Rosenberg in particular and the range and scale of the art that he owned and that was in his care.
Well, Paul Rosenberg was a phenomenon in and of himself. He was perhaps one of the most astute art dealers of his time, living in interwar Paris. He had an extraordinary eye for all things late 19th century, 20th century, specifically French Impressionist, Expressionist, Cubist, Modernism. Although he didn't really like German Expressionists, he really simply focused almost exclusively on the French. I mean, you don't consider Picasso as French, but he might as well be at this stage. And he amassed a collection in the thousands of objects. He was fortunate enough to spirit a number of those objects out of the country before the Nazis showed up. But unfortunately, the bulk was located in about five different sites. And because of denunciations in the Paris art market, most of those items that he was able to conceal were found and subject to removal and dispersal by the Nazis and their acolytes in the French art market. So we're talking about 700 pieces, which is what he reported to the French authorities at the end of the war. And therefore, one can have endless arguments about how much has actually been recovered, because you have to understand most of these claimants have been very discreet, and I can't blame them for that, about exactly the extent of their recoveries, because it's frankly not a public matter. It should be a private matter. But it does become public once these items are found in state collections or in private collections of a certain renown, or if they're exhibited and therefore identified and, you know, for the greater public to be cognizant of their existence. And this is what happened with the latest painting that was found in Norway.
And the New York Times has reported on the efforts of his family to regather the collection, which is really quite a story. How successful have they been?
Well, people like Paul Rosenberg were fairly successful because he was really a force of nature. I mean, he went to all the dealers in Paris, for instance, whom he suspected profited from the thefts, and he basically knocked on the doors and said, give it back. He sued a number of them, but others he struck deals with. He did the same thing in Switzerland, same thing in Germany, and same thing in Belgium, with varying degrees of success as a result of the laws that existed in those countries after the war. It's exhausting, you know, and he also is a businessman to begin with, so the torch was passed on to his children. Laws have changed, attitudes have changed, and it takes a lot more energy to regain a certain amount of public interest in these matters, and it takes possibly some additional noise, political pressure, unfortunately lawsuits, because the prevailing laws do not favor claimants. In fact, most countries decided not to pass special laws to facilitate restitutions, and that is unfortunate because it's not an issue that affected Jews necessarily, although they were specifically targeted, but many other folks were victims of these thefts, and they have suffered equally from these depredations caused by the Nazis and the collaborators.
I know that among other surviving family descendants of this interesting family is Anne Sinclair, the French journalist, the ex-wife of Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who has given a fascinating interview to Der Spiegel about living with this, a combination of a burden and a joy of this legacy of knowing that your family has lost a lot of sometimes masterpieces, and it's well, it's a mixed blessing in its own way, isn't it?
It is, and Anne should feel somewhat lucky because most of the pieces that Paul Rosenberg owned were of such quality that it's somewhat difficult to display them unless one is completely unfamiliar with them. So that partly explains a high rate of success, but at the same time, many of these pieces are still in private collections, and therefore it will take either massive acts of denunciation by fellow dealers or people who simply do not accept the fact that the current owners are in possession of stolen property. So it's a mixture of things. But again, families like the Rosenbergs are exceptions to the rule. For most people, they had to get on with their lives, which explains why there were not that many claims that were filed. And of course, you're shell-shocked. Psychologically, you're more interested initially in finding your loved ones, and you're not going to worry too much about your property. And then when you realize that your property is missing, well, the unfortunate occurs, which is that statutes of limitations run out and you no longer have any recourses to recover, and you have to basically accept a check in the mail.
Well, in fact, from what I read, the American Jewish community, the American Jewish peak organizations, they haven't exactly joined in the notion that it's worth a lengthy, complicated, systematic search to return all looted art.
Well, it's an interesting point that you raise. I've been somewhat surprised by this. I remember that when the portrait of Wally by Egon Schiele was subject to a seizure at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in January 1998, not a single Jewish organization basically came forward to defend the action of the then District Attorney of Manhattan, Mr. Morgenthau. So I think it's a complicated matter, to tell you the truth. It's one where many Jewish organizations have been very shy about getting involved in restitution matters because I think there's sort of an idea that if you focus on property, then you end up trivializing the significant losses of human life. But at the same time, it's kind of a false approach, because when you talk to the survivors, the first things that they mention to you are the actual physical losses, the palpable material losses around them. So their businesses, their apartments, the objects that they were so tied to emotionally, because after all, I mean, we all have special relationships with things that are around us, and there's absolutely no shame in it. And I think this is really what it's about. I mean, when a woman who is now in her early 90s wants her passara back from a museum, whether it's in America or in Europe, well, she wants it back because it meant so much to her. She doesn't want it back because she's going to turn it around and sell it. It's because finally she can get it back.
Yeah, but
taken away from her.
But I wonder if you've just touched on something very important. It might well be, might it not, that some of these works are in the very museums that they're visiting or have become patrons of or, you know, sit on their boards, and that it would be embarrassing to press the point. Because this has happened lately, hasn't it?
Yeah, it happens quite often. And what you don't want, in a certain sense, it's a fight within the Jewish community, for instance, but it happens more often than not because many owners of cultural property are, in fact, of Jewish descent in specific circles. But on the other hand, you have tons of people who are not Jewish who own this property. And it becomes very quickly an ecumenical question, but I think with regards to the Jewish question, it's something that hopefully it will dissipate soon, and then there will be this recognition that it is necessary, if not essential, to get involved in these matters because it is part of the history. And what you have to realize is that the crime of plunder is one of the few crimes, not the only crime, against humanity that has never been addressed properly since the International Military Tribunals at Nuremberg in 1946, despite the fact that the Allies were ready to hang specific individuals on those particular crimes. The crime itself is not taught. It's not part of any pedagogical curriculum in any Holocaust education program, whether it's in undergraduate or graduate courses. It really is, there is a black hole. In that it's almost as if it's too embarrassing and awkward to discuss something which is essentially an integral part of genocide. And also it was an integral part of anti-Semitic behavior.
Yeah, very interesting. So the law hasn't taken this up in a systematic fashion. The most recent case of this, correct me if I'm wrong on any point, was a gallery in Norway where a Matisse was held. It was actually on exhibition elsewhere at the time. It was at one of the Rosenberg Matisses. And they handed that back under pressure. But this was very much a one-off decision, wasn't it? And they're all like that, aren't they?
Yes. It's never systematic, and it's up to the institution. It's up to the country in which the institution is located. For instance, in Spain right now, there is a case pending, which obviously is not going very well, for a painting that's at the Bornemisza Museum. And essentially both the Bornemisza Museum and the Spanish authorities are reluctant to return it to the rightful owner, who lives in California. So it's really from one jurisdiction to the next. The Italians are some of the worst. I mean, they convert all of this property into state property. So therefore, even if you were able to convince the Italians to return it to you, they would simply tell you, well, fine, it's yours, but it stays in Italy. So if you want to enjoy it, you have to come to Italy and observe it wherever it's located. So what's the point of that?
So, I mean, is it conceivable that, say, in Australia, we might have some of this art?
It's quite possible because the many survivors who came to Australia and also the many war criminals who came to Australia. I mean, Australia was one of the favored destinations for hundreds of Eastern European war criminals. And they didn't exactly come empty-handed because many of them came out of displaced persons camps, so they ended up coming in the 1950s or even the 1960s. And by then, they had basically put their lives back together. And one should understand that art and cultural objects in general were a little bit like currency. In other words, you could basically, if you stole, let's say, jewelry from a Jewish family, then you can use the jewelry, parts thereof, to basically purchase an exit visa or papers on the black market. So this is a means to an end. And the fruits of plunder basically were extremely useful for many fleeing war criminals and collaborators alike to buy themselves essentially the equivalent of a retirement plan in a safe haven.
Now, of course, I can imagine that there'll be listeners saying to me, well, of course, in a reverse way, this is the problem for some of our Indigenous art that has been plundered, quotes, overseas. And, of course, there wasn't even individual ownership, which makes it more difficult. There were communities. So, as you say, once you start thinking about this, your mind does run.
So yes, I mean, there are absolute similarities because fundamentally what we're talking about is who owns culture and who has the right basically to say that you are not entitled to own that object because I can take better care of it, you don't deserve it, and I will put it in an institution or I will put it in my house and I will take care of it in a way that you cannot take care of it. So it's this extraordinarily condescending, patronizing language that one finds continuously. I mean, even when you read documents that emerged out of the post-war, written by the very people who were salvaging, quote-unquote, rescuing, safeguarding looted property in order to return it to the rightful owners, they were also making aesthetic decisions about what they felt was worthy of being saved and restituted and what was not. And so what you do is you find these governments actually in the post-war behaving, and I hate to say it, almost the same way as the Germans did one after they confiscated the works, and they started sorting it. So they basically made one pile of things that should go back to the market and another pile as to what should go to the Reich. So conversely, after the war, you had governments basically doing the same thing. The behavior was extraordinarily callous, which is one of the many reasons why this issue hasn't gone away.
I suppose they were sort of, I suppose to be fair, they were battling gigantic issues in the post-war, that post-war sort of devastation of Europe, and I suppose they have to draw up some priorities.
Yes, but not on the expense of the victims themselves.
Mm. I must just note, because my producers alerted me to the fact that the National Gallery of Victoria was the first Australian gallery, I don't know how many others, they established a list of work where the provenance had not yet been confirmed for the years 33 to 45 in consultation with an advisory committee that included senior members of the Jewish community. Now, is that the sort of thing you'd like to see a lot more of? And is it happening?
As one would say, it's better late than never. It's not enough, though, and this is really what I'd like to make very clear. It's not enough simply to post this kind of information and make it available to the public. Museums have a responsibility to themselves, to their boards, and to the public, and to those who finance them, to do what is referred to as due diligence. In other words, the practice of vetting, filtering, researching objects that are being accessioned and considered for acquisition should be thorough and systematic to the point where you can rightfully say at the end of the process that you did everything possible to find out the origin of the piece itself so that you can basically rest easier and more at peace and at the same time guarantee that you are being ethical. The problem is that until very recently, that was not systematic practice in museums regardless of where they are on this planet. Now, I don't know whether it's a cultural shift. I have no idea why, in the first place, people would not care to find out whether their million-dollar Monet painting was stolen or not. Certainly, you go to jail if you buy a hot car, so why doesn't that apply to art? We have a very different standard when it comes to art, and specifically cultural institutions have really gotten away with, I wouldn't say murder, but they have been allowed to do things in extraordinarily lax fashion. And now it's coming back to bite them. And in fact, you shouldn't be ashamed of it, because that's what the public wants, and this is what's so exciting about history, is that every piece has a history. And so what if it has a tortured history? And why not share that with the public? That's how you educate the public in the first place, don't you? Mm. And so why hide that?
It'd be lovely, actually, to have a sort of provenance, list beside paintings. That's quite an interesting idea, because so much of art is enjoying the history around it as well. Look, Mark Mazurowski, you've made me think. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Mark is from the Holocaust Art Restitution Project, and the New York Times this week also reported that a collection of drawings and paintings by Aboriginal children living in the Carrollup River Native Settlement in WA in the 40s and 50s will be returned. More than 100 pieces are involved in the transfer from Colgate University in Hamilton, New York, to Curtin University in Perth. So that is a genuine development. Maybe we'll see more.